and gentlemen, please put your hands together for the hardest working man in the game industry, the one man vortex of gaming information, the man who crashed Mario's party, ladies and gentlemen, Gaming Steve!
Hey there, welcome to Gaming Steve, the home of intelligent game discussion. I am your host, Stephen Glicker, and in this week's show, we go through the latest gaming news. I talk to Chris Satchel, the general manager of the game development division for Microsoft, and we talk about the XNA technology. I then review Dead Rising for the Xbox 360. Then I have the Name the Game contest, and then show mail, and then final thoughts. So, yeah, I know. The show's super-duper crazy late. There's actually a lot of reasons for it. Some of it is personal. Some of it is work-related, but a whole bunch of things. Real quick, I can don't really want to give excuses here, but the main thing is actually I've been working on a new game, believe it or not, and this one is this one's pretty crazy. It is a very, very, well, complex game. It's a very large game. For those of you who know about my history, I've done a tremendous amount of games, mostly casual games, a lot of web-based games, hundreds of web-based games, which, of course, are now like the hottest thing on earth, as well as a lot of child games, games for kids, you know, Harry Potter games, games for Blue's Clues, things like that, which makes me the hero of parents everywhere. But this game is actually, this one's pretty big. This is a much bigger game. This is a game, well, it's hard to explain, really. It's a, one of the things I want to do on the show is actually go through the game development process with all you guys from beginning to end. And this you never see is because people really try to keep their games secretive for as long as possible because they don't want the ideas stolen, or they don't want their developers stolen, or so many other things. But with this game, I'm trying to figure out a way so that I can take you from the development process from beginning to end, but I can't really tell you that much about the game. So it might be a little tricky for you guys to follow what's going on because it's under wrap and key, and also I don't want people to steal it. I have the exact same issues that other people have. But I will say that this game is the type of game that has to work on every single gaming platform known to man. Kind and in, hold up the integrity of the game no matter what you're playing it on. So if you're playing it on a console system or a PC or a portable system or even something as small as a cell phone, the gameplay has to be nearly identical. So it's really tricky to do that. So I'm gonna go through and explain to you from the beginning of the process on my shows, so that is something I think you guys will really enjoy and find out really what it takes. And you'll be amazed just how much it's like any other thing. I mean, it's really, you know, people think making games is all fun, and it is a lot of fun, but, you know, if anyone who's in software development is going to hear what I've been doing, and they're going to think, okay, there's no difference. There's really no difference between a standard software development app or even a website development application and creating a game. It's almost the same process in many ways. So that's really been keeping me very, very busy. And then also, and I'll probably get some flack for this, but I really don't care. So I kind of was a little depressed. When I heard E3 was canceled, I really went into this funk, and I really didn't want to deal with gaming. I'll explain that when I get to that news story. But yeah, it really hit me hard because it's one of my favorite times of year. And, you know, it just it affects actually me, not just in a personal way, but in a professional way too, because E3, and you guys are going to see, E3 allowed people, not just like myself, but a lot of people in the industry, a real good look behind the scenes. And that is going to really be gone. But again, I'll talk about that more because I actually did a little digging after I sort of got out of my funk because I wanted to find out exactly what happened. And now, in the long run, it looks like it's going to end up being okay in the long run, but I'm still going to miss going to E3 and seeing all my friends and all of that. But let's get into the gaming news and start the show proper. Gaming news. Hey, so before I get into the gaming news, I did want to, I almost forgot to talk about this, is that, yeah, I mentioned last time on my show that I'm looking for people to contribute to the site or help out with the site, and I got, oh, I don't know, a couple of hundred people wrote me, so yeah, I guess a lot of people were really interested in this. I didn't forget you all. I probably shouldn't have said something because I really wasn't quite ready for all of that. But I do have all your emails, and actually I have something I'm going to be sending out as a response because I'm trying to figure out a way, you know, to make Gaming Steve a site that you can go to that's just not another site. You know, I just don't want it to be. That's one thing I'm really interested in throughout my entire career, as well as, you know, just the overall site in general, is I just don't want it to be yet another gaming site that just has the same news that every other site does. And, you know, it just has this, you know, it's very easy for everyone to just post, oh, the latest, you know, information on the latest Sims expansion pack. And then you see the exact same story on 50 other games. Gaming sites. That's not really what I'm trying to do here, and I was trying to figure out a way to do this, but at the same time, without making it, impossible or inaccessible for average people. And I think I did. I think I actually came up with a nice little solution that I actually took from my years of being a newspaper editor in Pittsburgh, believe it or not. So look for that email. I figured I'm just doing the finishing touches, and I'm going to send that out shortly to everyone. So they should look for that in their mailboxes. And for those of you who are looking to contribute, just write me at feedback@gamingsteve.com, and I will send you out this email in a few days. With that, let's get into some news. So, man, what is going on? It's like everything is ending. E3 is ending. Now, Computer Gaming World is gone. It's like one of the oldest gaming magazines around that has been gone. It's sort of gone. It's going to be rehashed as Games for Window magazine, which is an integration between Ziff Davis and Microsoft. So what does that really mean? Well, my wife is in the magazine publishing industry. This is all she does. She used to be the production director for 17 Magazine. She actually got moved up and works a little bit higher up now at Hearst Publications. And I was talking to her a bit about this. And, you know, what happened is that I guess Microsoft is co-sponsoring the magazine. That what that means is that they're probably putting some money into the magazine, either directly or indirectly. Same way, a good example is Oprah Magazine. It's one of the most popular magazines, well, on the planet. And Oprah actually owns 50% of the magazine. But she also puts, you know, her name on it. She contributes to it. She really, you know, adds a lot to the magazine. So as much as Hearst makes on that magazine, they actually only make 50% because Oprah was able to help brand it. Microsoft, I believe, is probably doing the same thing with this Games for Windows magazine, is that, you know, they'll get a percentage of the proceeds, but they're going to push the crap out of this thing. Like, you know, and every time you buy an Xbox 360 game, I'm sure from now on, you're going to have a little insert in there saying, you know, subscribe to Games for Windows magazine. And, you know, through their marketing power and their, you know, their tenacity, they hope to really make this magazine into a huge monster. And I mean, it's a very, very smart marketing move on their part. And hopefully the magazine won't be too Windows-centric. You know, if it's just a PC gaming magazine, I'll be very happy. And actually, if it actually covers some of Vista gaming, whether it's on the cell phone or the Xbox 360 or the PC, I think that would be a pretty good magazine. But yeah, it's pretty stunning that they just sort of up and just killed that magazine. I don't know what the numbers were, but I imagine that they must have been pretty decent, although there have been rumors around that Ziff Davis is actually selling itself or portions of their magazines. I got to look into that a little bit more. I got to just ask my wife. She'll know. So what else do we got? Spore is heading to the consoles. Woo, big surprise. Yeah, I haven't had a huge amount of Spore news, but it does look like, you know, it's been leaked all over the place because Will Wright is now doing a lot of interviews about the game, and they appeared on a lot of sites throughout the web. And, you know, whether it's purposeful or accidental, he is leaking little things that it's going to be a huge franchise, that there's going to be cell phone versions, console versions, portable versions. You know, some of this is sort of iffy. Maybe it's going to happen. Maybe it's not going to happen. Let me tell you something. It's going to happen, okay? It's going to be one of their monster franchises. I've spoken to some of the guys at EA. They know, you know, this is like going to just be an absolute tremendous, tremendous franchise. They're going to make sure that this thing is on everything, okay? You're going to have Spore cereal. You're going to have Spore Underoos. You're going to have, oh, I don't know, Spore Pets. Well, that actually would be pretty cool, but I don't think we're really going to see that. But you get the gist. They're going to, this thing is going to be everywhere. It probably will, like, be the same, like The Sims. Its heart and soul will be on the PC, but it's going to be everywhere. So no big surprise there. Here we go. Almost $1 million of Call of Duty 2 maps were sold. So Activision CEO said that there were more than 500,000 Call of Duty downloads in the queue in his second quarter alone. This is one of the beautiful things. I've mentioned this many times on the show, is that a lot of these gaming companies are public. And if you really want to find out about some of the financials or like how much these games make, look at them up. Since these are public companies, they have to publish. They don't have to publish all their trade secrets, but they do have to publish at least base numbers. And according to their latest conference call, they went through some of the numbers. They actually said that the free bonus pack, which included two maps, they had 334,000 downloads. The $5 skirmish map pack was downloaded 105,000 times, and that generated $368,000 in money. And then the $10 invasion map pack had 66,000 downloads. And this is all on the Xbox 360, of course. And that raked in basically, $500,000. So, yeah, you can see those little downloads, those $5 downloads and those $10 downloads, they really can add up big time. And, you know, a lot of people were kind of scoffing at the horse armor and all these like little microtransactions, but you know, it's been my experience that often the people that you hear or make the most noise are not generally the people that are of the majority. And you know, just from everyone I've spoken to at Xbox, and there's no question that, you know, Live has been a huge success, and it's really been doing quite well. Even if a small percentage of people go and buy these $5 downloads, that can generate easily $250,000. And let me tell you, it doesn't take $250,000 worth of effort to make these map packs. Okay. In fact, these are probably just leftover packs. This happens all the time. In fact, like, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, the latest Blizzard expansion pack, not expansion pack, the latest patch in World of Warcraft, and there's some new dungeons. I believe it or not, I canceled my WoW account for now. Actually, all my friends did, and so did I. But that latest dungeon, that was made by my friend at Blizzard years ago. Like, he said he made that something like 4 years ago, and they just sort of threw it together, and they revamped it so it's, you know, in the latest patch. So not all the newest content is necessarily newest content. It's not, it, you know, they always have leftover things, you know, leftover maps, leftover devices that they didn't have time to necessarily get into the game. And then they go back and they're like, hey, you know, let's throw this together and put this on. So, you know, with this being said, that there's $1 million being made in these maps on the Xbox 360, I'm going to be very curious to read through the notes of EA's next press conference. Investors meeting to really hear about this, because these things are making a mint. And I could have told you that, because I basically dabbled in nothing but these little tiny downloads for games on the PC, and those things really add up. You know, as long as you have something that people want, you know, it's, you can also die a thousand deaths if you have a $5 map pack and then no one wants it or no one buys it, and then you're out of money. But yeah, I'm not too worried about these things. BioWare, it gets middleware for its MMORPG. So, yeah, there's all this rumor, speculation that they are working on an MMO. It seems like it's starting to get a little bit more solid, because it's been announced that BioWare bought this Hero engine for whatever they're working on. It's crazy. It's actually a tool that can be used for developers from everything from game design to actually billing players. And it's the heart of, Simutronic's own Hero Journey MMO game, which is set for release in 2007. So, yeah, these engines, that's pretty great. Actually, I wonder how much that thing cost. They're probably, an MMO engine, it's probably about It's probably about maybe, well, I don't know. I'm thinking like the Doom engine, I think, was about $250,000 for the Quake Doom engine. It's anywhere from $250,000, I believe, if you just want to buy it outright. I haven't seen the latest prices because I remember the Lithtech engine, I think, was only $100,000 at the time when that thing was out in 2000 or so. So an MMO engine is probably a good... probably a good quarter, and it's probably at least a half, maybe even $1 million, but it's well worth it. I mean, if it works and it does everything you need, especially billing and all of that, and that's really where a huge amount of time and effort is spent. That's why, like, NCSoft is able to crank out those MMOs, and they all have the same account system. They all have the same billing system. You know, that's all tied into this one system, and that is a huge amount of infrastructure just coming out with that junk. So yeah, I like the fact that BioWare actually went out to buy a licensed engine as opposed to trying to build their own, because BioWare, I love BioWare and I really do. I absolutely love them. I think they're a phenomenal developer, but they are great with story. But their technology skills they're good, but they always seem to have little bit of issues here and there. You know, like Knights of the Old Republic, love the game, but, you know, the graphics are just sort of kind of iffy. And, you know, actually, well, I will eat my words, because Mass Effect looks gorgeous beyond gorgeous. But I do know that they also have over, I was talking to the guy at E3, I forget how many developers he had on that thing. I think it's like 120 or something working on that. So, and they were using, I think it's the Unreal Engine, or was it, it was the Unreal Engine 3 for Mass Effect that they're using. So that's that's a nice thing, is that they buy the engine. It has everything in it, so the graphics are going to look good, the physics are going to work, and all they have to do is sort of build a game around it. Well, let's hurry this thing up. Let's see what else. Up, yeah, EA said Spore is not coming out until, well, originally they said July 2007. Now they're saying it maybe at the end of 2007. I wouldn't hold my breath. We'll know when Spore is going to come out, but I know a lot of people, including myself, can't wait for this thing. But those of you who heard this announcement when you started college as freshmen and now we're sophomores, you probably will be playing Spore after you graduate and are in the working world. So that's just my guess. NPD said July game sales were up 29%. Yeah, this is... I actually have a question later about this. But yeah, the stock market, as many of you know, I follow the stock market quite a bit, and the gaming stocks I've been following for, well, pretty much ever, when Activision was one of the very first companies listed on, they came out of NASDAQ, and they were one of the first, I think the first gaming public company, way back when I was actually a little kid. And that actually is what it got me into investing and into stocks. So you see, video games are good for everything, every aspect of life. So back to this is that, you know, the analysts, and I know people who are analysts, these guys don't know anything, okay? They guess, all right? Last month, they were saying that game sales were going to be terrible. And what do? They broke records. This month, oh, they're going to be terrible. Terrible. Game sales stink. The stocks stink. They should be lowered. The prices are crap. What are they? Ah, they're good. You know, of course, there was an increase, but 22% versus the year before. Let's see. DS game sales rose 354%. PSP sales slid 40%. And yada, yada, yada. Everything's doing great. Those guys don't know anything. I think I've told the story before. I remember a couple of years ago. Oh, God. And this is right at the... this was right at the height of, like, when Grand Theft Auto was doing great. It was right in the middle of Christmas season. Is a guy, an analyst, walked through Manhattan on the weekend and went into four stores in Manhattan and, quote, didn't like what he saw. And him just saying that made all the gaming stocks tank like 5 to 7% that one day. And they didn't really recover for the rest of Christmas, because this guy went into four stores in Manhattan and, quote, didn't like what he saw. So, yeah, in the end, you know, prices and how the company is doing will always prevail. But really don't listen to these analysts, okay? They don't know what they're talking about most times. They're really good with the numbers. They're really, really good at doing all the geeky stuff, but when it actually comes to guessing what's going to happen, unless they are getting these numbers ahead of time, or they have some way of finding out exactly what sales are before anyone else does, they're guessing as well as you or I, and they just make a lot of money doing it. Blizzard bans 59,000 accounts on World of Warcraft. So is this a really big news story? Yeah, I guess not. But 59,000 accounts, that's like a quarter of one of the biggest MMOs like in North America. I mean, they banned 59,000 accounts like it's nothing. I mean, that's probably at least half of City of Heroes, and that's more than Auto Assault, and that's probably about a quarter to maybe, I don't know how much EverQuest has right now, but, you know, it's a fair amount of EverQuest, and they just banned them. You know, they have 7 million accounts. 59,000, it's nothing. We'll just ban those guys. But that's crazy. That's a lot of accounts. Of course, you know, people who were, using third-party comp programs and farming gold and items and all that stuff. And they also removed, they removed 22 million gold from World of Warcraft's economy. So, oh, and by the way, did you see the latest patch? Is that they're going to have cross-realm PvP that, of course, I mentioned on the website months ago because, I probably shouldn't have said that because I heard some people at Blizzard might have gotten into trouble on that. But, I'm just waiting for Diablo 3 to come out, and then everything will come to fruition. World of Datecraft. Hey, is this the World of Warcraft show? No, I'm just pulling out these stories. So, yeah, if you want to see something funny, check out World of Datecraft. And I tell you, I almost wish that thing was around when I was single. When I was single, it really was not as prevalent, internet dating, things like that. But it's, now if you like World of Warcraft and you want to find someone else who also loves World of Warcraft, go to World of Datecraft. And maybe you two can find true love in World of Warcraft. I would have to say, my wife is not a gamer. I don't know if that would be a good thing if you had to sit over there fighting over the computer or if you're trying to, have a serious conversation or watch a movie, do something, and your wife or your loved one is sitting there trying to play games. See, I don't play games while my wife is really awake. I don't, actually. I only play games in my free time or at night. So I try to spend all my time in the family. So, yeah, I guess it's, I always wonder about that, if it's better to have been married to a true gamer, someone who did exactly like what I'd like to do, or someone who sort of likes a lot of similar things that I like, like movies and arts and New York and things like that, but not exactly the same as me. And I always wonder. Let's see what else. This card arcade hybrid game is heading to the DS. There's this game in Japan. I cannot pronounce this for the it's Sagukushi Tashin, which is a crazy popular game, and I'm always fascinated because I love collectible card games. It is a collectible card game that you bring to the arcade, and then you actually put the cards down and use the cards as a controller for the game. And so there's this like horizontal screen on the console, and then you put your cards down and they sort of act as armies, and then you move them around giving them orders. So it's a weird combination hybrid of collectible card game, arcade game, video game, and strategy tactics game. And from what I hear, it's awesome. I've always wanted to play this thing. It's huge. There's over 500,000 registered users in Japan. They've sold over 100 million trading cards. I'm sure there's some listeners out there who've played this game. I'd like love to hear from you guys. I've been dying to play this thing. There must be something in New York somewhere. Maybe in Chinatown or somewhere that they sell this thing. I'd love to just try it out. But back to the story is that, they're coming out with this game for the DS. It's coming out this fall, and hopefully it's I don't know if it's coming out into the I don't know if it's actually coming out in the U.S. It doesn't say in the story. I sure hope so. If not, I just might have to import this thing. There's not going to be physical cards, and you're going to hold the game, so you're going to hold the DS sideways like you would with Brain Age. And you'll be able to, I guess, put the cards on one side and control those. That would be like the touchscreen side. And then the other side, non-touchscreen side, would be like the arcade version side. So, man, that sounds freaking awesome. Back to the DS, the Japanese. Oh, by the way, they bought 10 million DSs after 20 months, which is, you know, of course, a new record. So I tell you, I've had every one of my friends come to me and said, oh my God, they bought a DS and they can't believe how awesome this thing is. I see people all over the place, you know, playing their DS. The DS Lite is actually what I'm talking about. Because, yeah, and the DS is good, but the DS Lite, yeah, that's a big step up. There's a noticeable experience difference when you're playing a DS Lite. And I too, myself, play my DS Lite on lunch breaks, things like that. And then finally, because I'm kind of running out of time here, even though I have a lot more news stories, yes, E3 has been renamed, it's been rescheduled, it's been dramatically resized, causing myself and many other in the industry to actually be pretty depressed, actually, about this. So, what happened, okay? Let's analyze this a little bit. Let's spend a little time on this one. So E3, which started out, what is it? I can't even remember now. Has it been 13, 14 years ago? I've gone to every single one. And it started out, you know, just sort of as a gaming convention. And it was supposed to be for members of the press only. Now, what does this mean? Okay, let's explore the history real quick and see what this means for the future. Is that this was somewhere that people could see games that were coming out 6 months down the road, a year down the road, maybe 2 years down the road. And who goes to these conventions? Well, press go to this convention, but more importantly, buyers. Like, oh, I don't know, people who buy games for Staples or Price Club or Toys R Us. You see those type of people at these conventions all over the place, because they want to see the product, and that is what these conventions are geared for. Now, why is that important? Well, because these type of conventions really are not open to the public, and in fact, are usually kind of secretive. Every industry has these conventions. It's not secretive that they exist, but they're not really meant for the public. They're not really meant to be covered and become a spectacle, because they have a lot of things that aren't really ready for prime time, if you will. You know, some of these conventions is that they're showing games and products and wares that are maybe 6 months to a year down the road, and you know, they really aren't ready to be judged. So E3, although it started out with a bang, it sort of transformed into something else. It went from being this, you know, trade show just for people and members of the press to a cultural event that everyone was following, and almost anyone who was even semi-related to gaming could get into. And that's not really what they wanted it to be, okay? There's other types of conventions. You see, those type of conventions are media, conventions for consumer conventions. A good example is like Digital Life. Digital Life is a convention in New York City that it comes to the Javits Center, I believe, in November. And when you go there, you'll see video games and products that are coming out in, I don't know, a week or a month or maybe 2 months. And these are basically finished products, or you're playing demos that you can download anywhere, and that's what they want to show to the public. They're not showing them the cutting edge stuff that's coming out 6 months from now or a year from now, or if they are, it's a very, very carefully canned demo that is really geared towards a general audience. You know, when I go to Digital Life, you know, it's not that interesting, because you know, a lot of the games they're showing are games that are already out, or games that are, you know, like the big sellers that Christmas, you know, things like that. So what happened? Why did this happen? Well, I kind of did some snooping around to find out why E3 has been, well, just to recap, because I didn't even really talk about the story. What happened is E3 has been resized. It now has something like, I don't know, 60,000, 65,000 people at this thing. It's getting totally ridiculous. It's being covered by every major news of organization. Everyone on Earth is going to this thing. It's funny. I mean, I go to GDC, the Game Developers Conference, which is a lot more low-key and a lot more what E3 used to be. And, you know, everyone there, all the press people in the press area, I know or have heard of, and it was great, you know. And these are all people really in the gaming industry, you know, the guys at Kotaku and the guys at Joystick and Evil Avatar and all those guys, they're all there. You know, GameSpot, of course, you know, all the biggies are there, of course. And, you know, major newspapers, magazines, things like that, you know, Time, Newsweek, etc., USA Today. But then you go to E3 and I don't recognize anyone. I mean, there's like, you know, all the most fringe of websites, and that's great. I loved it. But I mean, if you are even somewhat associated with gaming in any way, shape, or form, you can get into E3. And well, what happened? Well, now they're redoing E3 and they're trying to turn it back into the private press event that it was supposed to be all along. They're scaling down. It's only going to be about 5,000 people, and they're going to do kind of what they were planning on doing all along, is that they're going to show games that are coming out of 6 months to a year, but they just want to show it to professional journalists. They don't want to show it to, Gaming Steve or Joystick or Kotaku. Well, okay, I don't know if they're going to show it to those guys. They probably will. And I've been going to this every year, and I know a million people, so hopefully I'll still be able to get into E3. But, you know, I would say it's going to be very hard for anyone who doesn't really have really strong press credentials to get into E3 right now because, one little thing happened, like Sony presented their PS3, and instead of getting a lot of love and instead of getting a lot of affection, they've been getting nothing than judgments and a lot of criticism and a lot of negative articles written on them. EA also had a similar attack on them somewhat, where they didn't have exactly a killer lineup. Their stock price got totally tanked after E3, which is only ironic because their stock price has been doing great. That was actually a great buying opportunity. But the point is that, you know, professional journalists, when they do a preview of a product, it's a well-known fact that they will not judge, okay? If they go to a press event, they will try to always be as upbeat as possible, even though the thing could be, and I'm not talking about the PS3 here, I'm just talking about anything, okay? They could be looking at a TV set, okay? And they'll always be upbeat about the TV set, because it's a preview, and that's what professional journalistic integrity is, that they'll talk about it in a public, in a nice way, they'll talk about how great it is, all the potential, and only when it's actually released will they then review it and tear it to shreds and say, oh, this thing is a total piece of crap, don't waste your time, blah, blah, blah. But before that, there'll be nothing. It'll be nothing but roses and caviar. It'll be all happy, happy, joy, joy. Now, that's what the professionals will do. And that is what's going to happen with the new E3. I guarantee it, is that they're going to try to get all of the professionals in there. So when something like the PS3 gets announced, you're not going to have... they announce this crazy price of $600, they're going to have very thoughtful discussions. They're going to say all these, you know, neutral things about it. Or if they preview a game that's a total piece of crap, instead of having, I don't know, a million bloggers and websites saying, oh my God, this game totally stunk, and that noise of everyone else is overwhelming the, quote, professional game journalists, now you're going to have a very small and controlled event. And that is what's happening. Who was behind this? According to sources, they say, everyone's been saying that they no longer want this. But, you know, I've been hearing, Sony, I'm looking at you. Yeah, I've been hearing it's from you. I will be 100% fair. A lot of these game companies hate going to E3. They really do, because it takes them months to create these demos. Then all that time is wasted because they put together stuff that they never ever use. So they have to spend all these man hours putting together demos for E3. So that really cuts into the development cycle. And that could be 6 to 12 weeks gone. And 6 to 12 weeks in the middle of May, when you're trying to get something out by August or September, is death. Okay, it's really, really bad. I know most of my developer friends hate. They love E3, but they hate it if they have to work on it. It's just death for them. Another reason is that they have to put everyone up. I mean, everyone gets a week off, basically, to go to E3 because they're all in Southern California. Everyone has to get flown out there. It's very expensive. You know, you're going to read these things, oh, the booths are too expensive. All the monitors, that is crap, okay? Sony keeps reusing the same booths from year after year. Some of their stuff is new, but it's mostly the same booths they've been using forever. Microsoft, actually, they've been using components of their booth, but these guys, they use the same booths. Blizzard's been using the same booth year after year. Yeah, they have to update it a little bit here and there, but it's pretty much exactly the same. And not only that, I hate to break it to you, these guys have to do other conventions, okay? And if they're going to go to Gen Con or they're going to go to these other gaming conventions, they bring those same booths. So that's total crap when you hear that, okay? I hate to be so frank, but and I read that, it makes me angry because they're just lying to you. You know, they just didn't want to deal with it. They didn't want to deal with it. May was too early in the dev cycle, especially for things that are coming out in the Christmas season. That's why it was moved to July, because games will be a little closer to being finished. They'll be more polished. They make it nice and small, so you only get the professionals and the journalists to go to this thing, who are now going to say nothing but nice and happy, kind things about everything you see at E3, and a million other reasons. And personally, why I was so depressed about this is because I love E3. Hearing that E3 was canceled was the equivalent of having, I don't know, your birthday and Christmas and every single holiday combined canceled, for, at least for me. Because for me, I go out there. It's, you know, something I look forward to every year. I go out to California. I spend time. My brother lives out there. It's the one time a year I get to really see him. I have a million friends who live out in L.A. who work with gaming companies. I get to see them. And also, I get to actually see people in the game industry that I normally wouldn't meet. It's the one time where you can really meet and talk to everyone. It's a great gathering of people. And on top of that, it's fun. I mean, who wouldn't want to go out and play games for 3 days in a row? Well, after I kind of thought about that and after my boycott of games for a week or so, something interesting came along, which is all of a sudden every single major convention that has anything to do with games or computers or anything is seeing a huge void and is now saying, hey, wait a second, let's swoop in and take what E3 was doing and suck that out. And now Gen Con is going to have a huge section of their convention dedicated to video games. What was I saw? Was it PAX is going to have video games there. Like, every single convention that has anything to do with electronics is now having a huge video game selection added on to them. So suddenly, now instead of having to go to E3, Sony and Microsoft and all those other guys are now going to have to go to like 10 conventions this year. So it almost had the opposite effect. But that's not true, because instead of having to fly out everyone, they're just going to have to fly out the booths, and then they'll fly out some production managers and some mid to low-level people who will demo the games, who, you know, or sometimes they'll even hire people who will demo the games who don't even work on the team, and they only know the bare-bones basics, and you ask them questions, and they don't know. I love when that happens. But hopefully someone else will kind of swoop in and take over E3, and it'll become back to the way it was. But the old E3 of, you know, a million people descending onto LA and being able to see these games and being able to tell you their honest opinions of what they thought about this stuff is probably going away, at least for the short term. But, you know, I thought about it. I mean, with the new type of journalism out there, and the new type of journalism being, you know, the new age journalism, they call it, but really the internet journalism, where there's just so many blogs out there, you know, whether they're small ones to professional ones, or people like myself who have a lot of professional experience in the industry and actually want to get their voice out there. You know, there's such a low barrier to entry, is that this is something that they really can't stop. And they being, whether it's Sony or Microsoft or Nintendo or E3, you know, they really can't stop this type of journalism. It's going to continue and keep going on. So It's really amazing because I remember, you know, the last thing I was thinking when this happened is I was talking to all the guys at Microsoft the last E3 and right before it was over, and they were talking about how great it was and how they were preparing for next year, and, you know, they had this blogger bus and they were going to really improve it for next year, and they were just talking on and on and on about how they really were just going to make things great next year. So, you know, I find it really surprising when you see, oh yeah, Microsoft wanted this thing smaller, because every single person I've ever talked to at Microsoft is totally to the contrary, is that they really loved E3. And not only did they love E3, but they did an amazing job. They did a fantastic job of getting everyone in to see their games, to make sure that whether you were working for GameSpot or you're working for some site that just launched that covered Xbox 360 games for 1 week, that you were invited into the booth, you got to sit down, try their games, try them and play them for half an hour before anyone else in a really nice presentation, and they went out of their way, and they did a great job, while some other unnamed companies really went out of their way to make sure that you had no access whatsoever to their games, or incredibly limited access, so that as little as possible could be written, or what was written about, everyone sort of had the same experience. I wonder who that could be. Anyhow, there's my little tidbit on the E3. I'm going to continuously follow this story, because I guess now, the one good thing about E3 being canceled is I've never been to Gen Con. I've always wanted to go. As many of you know, I'm a big gamer in general and play board games and play role-playing games. In fact, I'm doing a D&D campaign right now with my friends in 3.5 rules. It's a lot of fun. And now, because E3 is gone, and I only get like a limited number of conventions I can go to a year because I got the family and kids and all that stuff, now I can actually go to Gen Con. I couldn't go this year, which kind of stunk, but they do have the Gen Con SoCal, which is the one in Southern California. I hear that's okay, but I definitely want to go to that one. Or the one I'm really looking forward to is Essen. That's the board game convention in Germany. That one's crazy. Over 110,000 people go to that thing. Think about that, okay? So, like, E3, which is considered monstrous and crazy, it's like 60,000 people. It's like it's 110,000 people. That is nuts. I think I just missed Essen as well. And also, I think they smoke in the convention hall, which isn't so great. But yeah, I definitely got to go to that. So I guess there's a silver lining. But yeah, if anyone has any additional questions about E3, because I did find out, it's just I can go on and do a whole show just on this. You know, do write me, game at GamingSteve, feedback at GamingSteve.com, and I'll answer those questions on the show. But I've sort of gone on a little bit too long on that. Oh boy, yeah, let's get to my interview with Chris Satchel.
Interview.
So this is my interview with Chris Satchel, who is going to talk about XNA. As some of you may have heard, Microsoft announced this program where you can purchase XNA and then develop your own games on the 360, and it's costing $99. It's still a little sketchy of exactly how this is going to work, but just the prospect of being able to make your own games on a 360 and being able to share it with other people is probably making thousands and thousands of would-be developers and people want to get into industry salivating out there. And also, it's got to be great. I mean, think about it, making your own game and having it working, a homebrew game on a 360 legitimately. I mean, man, I am really, every time I'm really been impressed with what Microsoft's been doing with the 360, and they just keep getting better and better. And with XNA, I'm pretty much blown away, because I think we're going to see some really, really fantastic stuff, and you're going to be finding a lot of new talent out there that normally wouldn't have a voice or might get, you know, ignored in the regular gaming industry. But now with XNA and being able to develop your own games, I think it's really going to take off. But let's listen to my interview with Chris. And actually, by the way, I did this interview a few months ago, but I kind of knew something was coming with XNA, so I was holding it off until now, and it was a good thing I did. So let's listen to Chris.
Hey, this is Gaming Steve here, and I'm sitting down with Chris Satchel, the General Manager of the Game Development Group at Microsoft. How are you doing today, Chris?
Doing great, Steve.
Thank you very much for sitting down with me. So, Chris, I wanted to jump in and talk about XNA, because we saw XNA 2 years ago at GDC, and we've been hearing about it, and now it's officially out. So why should we care about XNA? What is that going to mean to your average gamer?
Well, what it's going to mean to your average gamer is you're going to see a lot more innovation in the marketplace, because with XNA, especially XNA Framework, we've made a system that makes it much easier to create games and then get those games across Microsoft platforms. And if you make it easier, it means more people can come with innovative ideas and do new things that are really going to excite gamers. So I think what you're going to see is some great new concepts and some great variety because we've made it easier.
And for people who aren't, you know, game developers and don't know, you know, because they hear these, you know, buzzwords like what XNA, you know, XNA, XNA, but what is it exactly? Like, what is it?
So XNA has actually got a couple of different facets. The main one is it's a suite of tools and technologies that help developers make games more efficiently. We have things like XNA Build, which is for the big development teams and helps them use, you know, with these great big teams, helps them run efficiently. We have XNA Framework, which makes it much easier to create games, and we think we're going to see a lot of casual and indie developers use that in the first instance. But also, XNA is a bigger initiative at Microsoft just to make it easier for game developers to create games on our platforms. Because if we make it easier for them, then you get better games and you get more games. And that's really what consumers, I think, would look for.
And what platforms is XNA going to be running on when it first launches?
XNA will be on Windows and Xbox 360. Although we'll say the tool side of it, just like our compilers at Microsoft get used for every sort of platform in the world, XNA Build will be able to be used to deliver content on any platform.
So basically, you'll be able to develop something, you know, say using the XNA tools on the PC, and then very easily port it over to the Xbox 360 with minimal effort.
Absolutely. In fact, our goal is to have it so you don't even port it. It's really just a retarget. Literally, press a button and it appears on the other platform. That would be our vision.
So, are you worried about, you know, having a lot of rehashes of titles and games? Like, you know, for the Xbox, I was talking about this earlier, with the, you know, a lot of titles would show up on both the PC and the Xbox. And, you know, even right now, we saw Oblivion show up on the 360 and the Xbox at the same time. Are you worried that, you know, XNA is so good it might cannibalize 360 sales of games?
No, I think that if you put this technology in developer hands, I think what you'll get is new game experiences. I mean, what I'm passionate about and what I'm trying to do is make the indie films for games. How do you get people that can create these new experiences without having to spend $10 or $15 or $20 million? So I think if you get that innovation out there, then that's how you broaden the market, and that's how you get gamers excited. And so I'm not worried about it cannibalizing. I think it's really going to open up the market.
And so when are we going to get our hands, or, like, you know, we hear about this XNA, how do we get this, how do we start fooling around with it for programmers that, you know C-sharp, that are want to get into game development? How do they do this?
We're going to be releasing a community tech preview of XNA Framework this summer. Here at the show, you can get your hands on XNA Build, which is the sort of infrastructure technology for building content for games. So you've got your art package and you've got your game engine, and this is the thing that sits in between that helps you build effectively. The other thing we've done, which your listeners might be interested in, is on that disc, and you can also get it from our website, we've actually given away the full source to Met Commander 2 for the PC. And this is just to let people, you know, play with our systems, have some fun, perhaps start to get into modding. And we just really wanted to give something to the community that they could play with.
And do you have XNA tools for Xbox Live Arcade as well? Or is it, how does that work with you know, the different platforms or the different segments of Xbox?
Well, I think XNA Framework initially will be very focused on the Xbox Live Arcade games. I think a lot of people are going to want to use it to build those games because it allows you to do those, doesn't have to be simple from a technology perspective, but those cool sort of casual games, make them very quickly. And what they want to do is try out their ideas very quickly and get them on arcade. And I think Framework will be a key technology enabling people to do that.
So, all right, I think we've talked about XNA a lot right now. So I just want to jump real quick into just general gaming. So I've been seeing that a big announcement about you guys want to get back into PC game development. It was sort of a shock because I thought you guys were doing a pretty good job with PC game development. At my E3 last year, I gave you guys at least my game show of my award of the best games of the show. You know, when I saw Rise of Nations and I saw AoE 3 and Dungeon Siege 2, which I love. I thought you guys had, like, some of the best games, so I was surprised that you felt like you've been ignoring that crowd in the last few years, and you're almost reiterating your, not dominance, but commitment to the PC gamer.
I agree with you. Those games were excellent, and I love. I got to work a little bit on Rise of Nations, and it's an amazing game. And so I think what we're saying is we've got great games out there, and the online market has been absolutely booming. But what we want to do is bring some of the branding and kind of the retail channel sort of experience we've learned with the console and bring that to Windows gaming, because, you know, although you've got these great games, we want to make it better. We want to make a bigger market for game developers. We want to make it better for consumers. And I think what we're saying is we want to focus on that and really really expand the retail channel and make that really strong, like you see for the console presence.
So does that mean you're going to have more games that are going to be on the PC that Windows is going to help fund directly or indirectly? Like, what does that mean for us, the consumer?
I think for the consumer, it means better quality games. I mean, there's some amazing games out there, but, you know, more consistency, easier to use experiences, more controllable environment. Like, if you're a parent, things we've done in Vista with parental controls or family settings, as we call it, that gives you a lot of control, and it makes it easy as a parent to let your children play games in a controlled fashion. When you do these things, it just makes that market more vibrant. And then you add like a retail channel to it and branding and something that you know is going to work and work well. I think that just helps get the great ideas we see on Windows and make it easier for gamers to get into it.
And what's this Plays for Sure? Is that what it's called? I believe that I heard some rumblings about. Could you explain that a little bit more?
Well, Plays for Sure was a scheme to try and help consumers understand that the game would just work well on their system. Because, you know, always with Windows, there's lots of configurations out there. We want to make sure that people understand, hey, I can just take this and I can just play it, and it's going to work great, and it's going to work great on the Microsoft platforms.
And what is it? I heard something that it's going to be like color-coded or something on the games, or is that not determined yet? Is that, you know, so if you know that you can run, and this is for Vista, is that you can run Vista, and it'll go through and look at your settings, and it'll say, okay, you are orange, and you can run anything orange or higher. Is that correct?
I think that the method of communicating that is still being worked on to make it as smooth as possible. But yeah, there's basically a game advisor that can look at your system and say, okay, here's how your system performance, and here's how you make it better. If you'd like to see more performance, you should do X or Y. And so we're very focused on making it much simpler for people to understand how well a game's going to work on their system.
So you're trying to make it almost, and we were talking about this in the breakfast, almost trying to make the Vista gaming experience almost like a console launch? I mean, you guys said that a few times.
Well, I think you've got, on Windows, amazing innovation and amazing games. And what we want to do is bring the good side of console to it. So bring that side of consistency, of ease of use. And when you pair that with the amazing innovation you see on Windows, I think you get a very powerful gaming experience. So in that way, it is a little console-like. But that's not we're not talking about making it play like console games. What we're saying is those great Windows-type games, but making it as easy to use as a console.
Which I think a lot of people are going to want, because, I mean, I'm a hardcore PC gamer, and, you know, part of a PC gaming, I don't know whether it's fun or work at this point, is like tweaking your system just right so you get the most amount of frames per second on your first-person shooter, and, you know, having your video card. And at this point, especially with the next-gen systems, you know, I'm starting to get a little tired of doing that continuously, of spending, you know, buying a game, spending an hour or two or three tweaking it so I get my best performance possible, and then playing it. And, you know, a lot of hardcore gamers like that, but as the consoles are getting more and more powerful, you know, I don't think people are going to want to do that anymore. So is that what you're trying to do, is make it easier for people like, not even like me, but, you know, your average or people that are tired of doing that, to make it easier to play games?
Yeah, we definitely like to make it as easy as possible. As you said, you know, you've bought the game. What you want to do is get into that experience as fast as possible and have the best experience. And we want to make that as easy as possible so you don't have to spend all that time tweaking and playing with it. You actually get to play the game instead.
So on Vista, what tools or features are we going to see that are going to help us that you can talk about?
Well, there's the Game Advisor that helps you look at the performance of your system we talked about before. There's the family settings, right, which is important, because I think any next-generation operating system needs the ability for parents to control what their children do and be able to watch what they're doing and make a safe environment. There's also the Game Explorer, so you'll see gaming being a sort of front and central in Vista. You'll see it makes it much easier to manage all your downloads. You can see all the information on the game, any new information from the publisher, manage all any updates, which makes that much easier. And then, of course, a big innovation is D3D10. So we've got Direct3D10, which means you're going to see new levels of graphics performance. And the other thing there that's quite subtle is when you can move more processing off onto your graphics card, which D3D10 allows you to do, it leaves more room on the CPU for innovative AI or physics or other things in the gameplay. So when you wrap that together, you're going to get a great game experience. Mm-hmm.
and Vista. I mean, it was pushed back, and that was just announced a few days ago, but sort of, because the business version, there's like 8 flavors of Vista or something I read. You know, the business version is coming in November, and the home edition's coming out in January, supposedly. But, I mean, if I get the business, I mean, I run XP Professional, but if I get the business edition, I'll be able to run all these games, and it won't be any issues.
You will be able to run, but remember, when we say it's the business version, it's the version that we do sell direct to business. Oh, the consumer version that you'll see sort of either OEM'd or available for consumers, that's what's coming out in January. As to the versions, there's really 5. There's 2 for business, so a standard level and a sort of higher level. There's 2 for consumer, and then what we did is we had one that's like, there's a lot of people that you say, what do you want? And they're like, I want everything, give me it all. Right. You're like, do you really want it all? They're like, sure. And so there's an Uber SKU, which is just like the everything SKU. So for those people that really just want everything in the system.
But the gaming experience, I mean, just like Windows XP Pro and Home will be the same on all the systems? Or are you putting in things that will limit the businesses from playing games at work? Those sneaky bastards.
I don't really have any information on that. Our goal normally isn't to limit anything for our customers. You know, people can configure their systems however they want.
So, Chris, I wanted to thank you very much for taking the time out and talking with me.
Thanks for taking the time, Steve.
Hey, so once again, Chris, thank you very much for your interview. And hopefully that gives you a little bit of idea what XNA is all about, because I really, and myself, was not even sure when this thing was announced 2 years ago. I was like, what the heck is this thing? And we're finally getting to see. So let's get to my review of Dead Rising for the 360. Ooh.
Game review!
So Dead Rising for the Xbox 360. This game, I would say, is almost review-proof, because if you have a 360, you probably have this game already. If you don't have a 360, you're probably going to buy this game, but I'm going to review it anyhow for those two of you who don't have it out there. But yes, Dead Rising is a new game from Capcom where you play Frank, the photographer, who has to, basically survive in a shopping mall filled with hundreds of thousands of zombies. The point of the game is to survive, make it through the story, and then kill them. Kill them and kill them some more. And where does the fun come from this game? Oh, I don't know, killing zombies? Seriously, if there's been, you know, Resident Evil, and there's a lot of zombie games out there, but this is the granddaddy of them all. This, I've never seen any game that really encompasses the whole feel of zombiedom that Dead Rising does. Of course, you know, who doesn't love having a shopping mall filled with zombies and being able to pick up pretty much anything you could imagine to kill them with? And that's really where a lot of the fun comes in this game, is that, you're going through the hardware store and then you see hedge clippers and you go, hedge clippers? This is going to be bloody. Let's go have some fun. Or you go through the toy store and you see a water pistol and you think, a water pistol? How the heck is a water pistol going to hurt a zombie? Oh, well, let's go find out. And that's where really a lot of joy comes in the game. You can go to, you know, a record store and there's like CDs, and you're like, CDs? All right, cool. And they don't really hurt them, but it's just fun. And you can have them sticking out of their head. One of the other fun parts about this game is that you're actually taking pictures of the people and the zombies. And what you're trying to do is actually capture certain moments. So if you, do something really nasty to a zombie, like decapitated, you can take a picture right afterwards and you get mad points for doing that. It's called a prestige points, I believe they're called. They're experience points. I just call them experience points. As you get experience points, you will level up and you'll get new skills, you get new abilities, you'll gain more health, you'll get special moves. A lot of these special moves you end up really not using, and there seems to be a little bit of imbalance between some of these special items. Like, you know, it's always nice to get a little bit more health. It's also real nice to get a little bit more carrying capacity. But man, when you can move faster, because you start off the game kind of moving slowly, but when you get that boost of speed, the game is night and day. So that's the good things about the game. Let's talk about the bad stuff. All right, you've probably heard a lot about this, but one of the big things is a lot of people are complaining about, you only get one save, all right? That's it, one save. Now, people complaining, but you know what? It's not that bad, all right? I have two game, the memory cards. you can save on your memory card. So put two memory cards in, or put a memory card in, voila, now you have three places to save your game. That's what I do. I have it on the hard drive and I have it on two memory cards. Not a big deal. But the other parts, well, if you ever wanted to see a developer force their play style onto a player, play this game. I've seen it done a lot. I've seen it done in a lot of the Resident Evil games, but this is probably the most grossly... It's almost broken, I would say. You know, first there's the game system, save system, which is kind of annoying. You have to save in bathrooms and in other, you know, and there's this also this one area where you can save where you're dropping off all the survivors. That's bad enough, is that you actually have to try to find these places to save the game. The other aspect is they just have a lot of weird choices. Like, for instance, after you've saved your game, they say, well, would you like to save or would you like to quit? Well, if you say quit, well, you quit the game and you start over from the beginning, okay? My friend lost, like, I don't want to tell you, he lost, like, 10 hours of work. Well, not 10, because it only takes about 10 hours to finish the game. But he was almost at the end, and he did that by accident, and he only had one save game, and he lost everything, okay? The good news is that, and this is another interesting aspect, is that your character always stays the same. So if you start the game over and your character, Frank, is like level 15, you start at level 15 with the same amount of experience points. So you don't have to start the game from the very beginning. Another thing about this game is that because of the save system, it's really unforgiving. And there's and you also have a time limit in this game. And it's one thing I hate about games. I hate games that have time limits. But because you have a time limit, and because you only have one save, and because you always have to find these save points, and you can die at any time, what are they trying to do? Oh, the developer's trying to give you a sense of dread and fear. And you know what? It works, okay? I do dread and fear that I'm going to have to replay the same level 50 times, or I'm going to have to kill the same guy 50 damn times because this one thing keeps killing me, and I have to keep reloading it over and over and over again, okay? Is that dread and fear? No, that's annoyance, okay? I hate when developers do this. I hate when they force you thinking that it adds more, you know, length to the game, or it adds more stress. The original Hitman did this as well. And you know what, developers? I'm telling you right now, stop it, okay? Please stop it. It doesn't work, all right? We're mature now. We know how the games work. You don't need to impose your little rules and strict, you know, ways to play the game so that it's harder for us or stricter and it's scarier for us. I can't, you know, there has to be a happy medium between this and, I don't know, Prey, where you can never, you know, you basically can save anywhere and never die, which is almost, there's no point to a save system really, because you just never die. Eventually you'll get through every single aspect of the game and every single boss battle because it's impossible to die. There has to be a happy medium between those two, and that really, really bothers me. Something else about this game is the difficulty level. It's because of the way it's set up, is that you have to almost play the game twice. You have to play the game once to figure out how to do something in the game, and then, of course, you'll eventually run out of time, and then you won't be able to complete the missions, and so on and so forth, and then you have to play it a second time to actually then do it correctly. This isn't always the case, but it is... I was actually playing this game, and the first time I played it, I was really hating it. But yet, I just loved the aspect of killing zombies and just loved the whole feel of the game, and I just couldn't stop putting it down. So what I did is, when my character was about level 12, I reset the game, started it over, and boy... I've been having a great time ever since. It's 1,000 times better to do that. In fact, everyone who has the game, I just highly recommend you do that, because now you're a lot more powerful, and on top of that, you actually kind of know what you're doing now, and it just makes the whole gameplay experience a little bit smoother. If they didn't have such a harsh save system, this wouldn't be necessary. Well, anyhow... You know, Dead Rising, you kind of get the idea. It is a fun game. There's a lot of great things about it. The sound work is fantastic. The zombies are a lot of fun. They'll also attack you and kill you in unique ways. One thing I was wondering about, I'm kind of surprised we haven't heard from Jack Thompson on this one, and this is all I'm going to say, is that the women zombies, when they bite and attack the men zombies, they do it in a pretty personal place, and then they do a little interesting move afterwards. This is a family show, so I'm not really going to get into that any more than I just did, but let's just say that, take a little closer look at it, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Anyhow, This game is definitely fun. You can even rent this game and have a lot of fun with it. It's not super crazy long, but it does have a lot of replay value. $60, it's a little expensive. I actually got my version. I actually came in to buy it the day it came out, and I got mine at $5 off at GameStop because a guy bought it for his kid, played it, and didn't realize how insanely violent it was. And let me tell you, this game is violent. When you get the samurai sword, you can cut zombies in half or in quarters. Yeah, it's pretty gruesome. Or the battle axe. Ooh, the battle axe. Or the lawnmower. Ooh, the lawn. That one's nasty. Yeah, this is a gruesome game. But yeah, I give this game 4 out of 5. If it wasn't for the crazy, crazy save system, the way it forces you to slowly get through the game, forces you to replay areas over and over again, this game would be great. 5 out of 5. But oh, it's so much fun. It's just so much fun. It's got to still get a 4 out of 5. Give this game a try. Let's get to name that game. So this is Name That Game, where I will play a game, and you have to tell me the name of the game of the platform, and then I will send you a cool rad prize. So let's listen to last show's game clip. Yeah, I was wondering if that one was too easy, and I probably was too easy since I got hundreds of replies. So let's take one of them out real quick. Let's see. Hey, Steve, I hope it's not too late for this week's clip. I think it was a clip of Kratos ripping something off a nasty mythical beastie in God of War for the PlayStation 2. Keep up the great work on the podcast. Still the cream of the crop. Ben Brown, Concord, New Hampshire. Hey, Ben Brown, congratulations, you've won. Concord, New Hampshire. New Hampshire, awesome state. A lot of my friends from college are from New Hampshire, and they were in Nashua, I believe, is where they were from. But yeah, it's great up there. Cheap liquor. That's where everyone goes in Massachusetts. But yeah, Brit Ben, send me an email with your address, and I'm going to send you something game-related. Send me your shirt size, too, because I got a ton of gaming t-shirts, and I definitely have to send that stuff out to you. So anyhow, let's listen to this week's entry, and if you think you know it, send me an email to gameatgamingsteve.com with the name of the game and the platform it's on. So let's listen to this week's entry. So once again, if you think you know it, send me an email at game@gamingsteve.com. And if you are lucky and are picked, you will win something. I don't know. I got tons of swag. You get something cool. Let's get to show mail.
Show mail.
So this is the time of the show where I answer your questions. If you send me an MP3 question, I will normally almost always answer it as long as it's intelligible and I can understand it. And you can send your questions to feedback@gamingsteve. You can also send your print questions. If I don't write them on the air, I will usually write you back the answers anyhow. But let's listen to the first question from, I don't know, I think this is like his fourth or fifth question on the show, but he keeps sending them, so I'll keep answering them.
Hey Steve, this is Lawrence Bly from the Netherlands, your big fan. I like your input on what has happened with Shiny Entertainment. They used to make very interesting and unique games like Earthworm Jim, Messiah, MDK, Sacrifice. But nowadays they are only doing very mediocre games. What has happened with Shiny Entertainment? I love what they did, and no other company has ever done anything unique as that than what Shiny did. Love your input, love your show again. Goodbye.
Hey, Lawrence Bly from the Netherlands. How you doing, man? Shiny Entertainment. Shiny, man. They made great games. They made MDK. They made Messiah, which I didn't really love that much, but they made Sacrifice. You want to play a crazy, crazy RTS? Get that game. That is a great, crazy game. But what happened to them? How'd they lose their edge? Simple. They were bought by Atari. That's how they lost their edge. Not that it was necessarily Atari, but a lot of these companies, you know, what happens is that when they get bought by larger companies, they can get bought by larger companies for just their IPs, their intellectual properties, and then one or two key people. Give you an example. When EA bought Maxis, do you think they bought Maxis because of the 100 cool programmers? No, they bought Maxis because of Will Wright was attached to it, and, oh, I don't know, SimCity, and all of those great games as well. Well, the SimCity game, because the Sims didn't come out yet. And that's what they really did. And when they bought, you know, Shiny, they thought, oh, you know, they bought some of their games. They bought, the president, I can't even remember his damn name. Dave Parry. There we go. It was on the top of my tongue. Dave Parry, you know, they brought him on board. And, well, you know, when these games companies get bought, things happen to them, and you know they gel differently. They get mixed in with other groups. I myself sold my company. I know this firsthand of exactly what happens, and it's not always a pretty picture. So, you know, when you hear these game companies get bought, often it's very rare that the companies are kept on their own. Is that, you know, the corporation that bought them really wants to now mix it up. They want to take their assets. They want to put in new people, move them around, move their offices, and so on. And, you know, some very small things can really change a lot in these games. Schedules get changed, so many things. But, you know, Dave Parry's working on a new game. I think he's doing an MMO of some sort. So hopefully they'll come back and he'll do sort of like what Peter Molyneux did, is that he just kept reinventing himself with new game companies, one right after another, after he sold Bullfrog and did Lionhead, and now he's on Microsoft. And there's an example of how it might turn out really great, because Microsoft and their backing and their power, and they're kind of like, you know, really, really letting him run the show and do his own thing. Hopefully we'll be able to see like Dungeon Keeper 3. Oh man, that'd be great. Like on the Xbox 360, that'd be fantastic. Or another theme park, that'd be awesome. Let's get to the next question.
Good morning, Steve. I was wondering what you thought about Valve's recent announcement regarding Team Fortress 2 and Portal. I know there have been quite a few people that have been waiting ages to play Team Fortress 2, and the addition of Portal to the announcement just made it that much sweeter. Are you looking forward to either of these games? What do you think of Portal, and what do you think of the new artistic style in Team Fortress 2? Thanks much.
Hey man, so yeah, Team Fortress 2, I forgot to mention that on one of my shows. It was big news and I like totally missed it. I spaced on that one. Team Fortress 2 looks freaking awesome, okay? My favorite PC title of all time is No One Lives Forever, which is sort of like the 60 spy spoof first-person shooter. Team Fortress 2 kind of looks like it, so therefore Team Fortress 2 looks freaking awesome. Portal looks crazy. Portal looks like it's going to hurt your brain. And Portal, by the way, is a puzzle game. And so definitely take a look at these games. If you haven't seen them, go to YouTube. You can find them, or just type them in Google and you can actually see the demo. But Team Fortress 2 looks really, really good. And it's actually brilliant, because what they want to do when you do a sequel of a huge best-selling game like Team Fortress is that you have to keep the gameplay intact. So how do you do that? How do you come out with a sequel keeping the gameplay nearly intact without changing it and yet making the game better? And the easiest way to do that is to reskin the game, you know, make it look and feel different, but yet keep the integrity of the game exactly the same. That's what they look like they did with Team Fortress 2. So, you know, people love Team Fortress is going to love Team Fortress 2, because I'm pretty sure that the gameplay is going to be nearly the same, you know, enhanced and, you know, modified, but it's going to be the same gameplay, but the graphics are going to be totally different. The look and feel, they'll probably enhance it a little bit here and there, but you know, it feels now like a totally different game, yet it's the same game. You know, it's like a minor upgrade. That's the smart way to go. That was very smart. And then Portal, man, Portal looks like it's just going to hurt your brain. But that looks like a ton of fun. I'm looking forward to that one. Definitely check them out on YouTube. Let's get to the next question.
Hey, Steve, this is Robin from Indiana. I'm a big Squeenix fan, so I'm one of those people who are pretty distraught about the PS3. A lot of gamers out there are pretty young, so it's not even simple outrage. The fact is that college students, or people who are just getting a start in life like me, just straight up can't afford the thing, even if we were to save up and eat ramen for a year. It's just not an option. So, at the same time, I'm really interested in a couple of games that would be coming out for Final Fantasy XIII, even though we've just seen a trailer for it, and that's all. But, I guess my question is, what would happen to these hardline PS3 games, like Final Fantasy XIII, and to companies like Squeenix, who tend to stick with the PlayStation? Thanks a lot.
Hey, Robin. Is that Robin? Yeah, Robin from Indiana. Yeah, I hear your pain. The PS3, especially college students and people tied to money, what are you going to do? Especially if you want to play Squeenix games, you know, like Final Fantasy 13 and 12 and all those. Yeah, you're going to have to wait. It's going to stink. I'm going to tell you that right now. Enjoy Final Fantasy 12. It's supposed to be freaking phenomenal, so that should hold you over for quite some time. I would strongly recommend, go get Dragon Warrior 8. That thing just came down to $20. That game was freaking fantastic. I love that game. Go buy Dragon Warrior 8. You'll love that game. It gives you tons and tons of action, but what's going to happen to these other hardcore PS developers? Well, hopefully, you see, two things. One, Japan, because a lot of these developers, they develop not for the American market, but for the Japanese market. American market is definitely helpful, but their hardcore is the Japanese market by far. So as long as Sony, even if Sony totally bombs in the US, as long as the PS3 sells in Japan, they'll be fine. They definitely will prefer if the PS3 sells everywhere in the world, but as long as they sells really, really well, it's going to be fine. If not, well, then you're going to see them defecting quickly. The other thing is that these developers, they get paid off by Sony to be kept exclusive. Okay, they get, you know, huge amounts of money. Sometimes they get money up front. Sometimes they'll get minimum amounts. So, like, even if the game only sells one copy, Sony will give them, base amount of money. There's a million ways those deals are worked out. They'll say, you know what, okay, we're going to give you $20 million minimum for this game. So even if it totally bombs, we want to make sure that you stay exclusive to the PlayStation 3. So, you know what? The big developers like Squeenix and stuff, I would totally not worry about them. They're going to do fine. They'll be able to, you know, these are huge companies. It's really the smaller kind of indie developers that decided to go with maybe the PlayStation 3 in Japan. Those are the ones I worry about a little bit more, but really don't worry about it. And if you can't afford it, you know what? There's so many games out for the PlayStation 2, so many role-playing games, really good ones, that you really won't... You will never be bored. I guarantee you that. You'll always have something to do. And let's get to the next question.
Hello.
Hi, Game and Steve. This is Baby Monster Dad from the My Baby Monsters Children's Story Sharing Podcast. Love your show, and I was just wondering, as a longtime gamer both on the PC and the console, I've been a Sony fan for quite a while, and now as the parent of two, with a wife, there is no way the Sony PlayStation 3 is going to make into our house at that price point.
So,
I was wondering if you think that the PlayStation 3 will make into a lot of other houses with families whose parents make the decisions, or they will all go Wii.
Hey, Baby Monster Dad. So, was that an advertisement or a question? Well, I didn't really love that, but I'll let it because the kid's kind of cute, and I have a little kid, too, and I love little kids. So, yeah, will the PlayStation 3 make it into parents' households, or will it be the Wii? It'll be the Wii. It's simple as that. Same way that GameCube, a lot of my friends who are kids, and they would ask me, like, what to buy their kids, and I always said a GameCube because it has kids' games on it, okay? It doesn't matter the technology. It matters what you can play on it, okay? My kid, who's very, very young, she's not even two yet, she is sitting there on the computer typing, I kid you not, playing Elmo, because there's this thing where Elmo will ask you to type certain letters. I'm sitting there thinking, my kid is going to learn how to type by the time she's two, okay? And that's not exactly okay. I know friends of mine, or really friends of my parents, or should I say my my friends and their parents, there we go, who can't even use a computer, as well as my daughter can't. So, yeah, it's not so much the technology, it's the games on it. And, you know, Nintendo has always, you know, really geared itself towards the kids' market, towards kids' gaming. And now, being able to use a controller that really requires very little hand-eye coordination and dexterity, that's going to be killer. I mean, think about that. If you have a game like an Elmo game, if I was developing something, if I did a Sesame Street game on the Wii where you can take the controller and like shake it or do different things with it, and it actually will then cause things to happen on the screen, you can have that. You can have even the youngest kids using that thing. While a PlayStation 3 controller, you really have to be, I don't know, maybe I'd say six or so before you can really get, I mean, yeah, I know I'm going to get people, oh, my four-year-old uses it, oh, my three-year-old uses it. Yes, they can, but to really get the full experience and to really get it, it'll probably be required like around 6 years old, maybe even seven or eight. But yeah, I it's always Nintendo. They always seem to win out when it comes to that, those sort of things. And it doesn't hurt that they also have, you know, portable games. And you go to schools, my niece, who's nine, you know, she says every single person in her class has a Game Boy, has a DS. Everyone. She's like the only one who doesn't. She got the iPod instead. It was either the iPod or the DS, and she got the iPod. But, you know, you can't go to school without having one. And if you don't have one, then you're shunned. Shunned! So, yeah, all hail Nintendo parents. And let's get to the next question.
Hi, Steve. This is Quentin from Ohio again, and I have two questions about Gears of War. First, what's with all the debate over the $60 price? I don't remember Microsoft stating they would continue publishing titles at $50 while the market is going to a $60 standard. And I'm also pretty sure that I paid $60 for Perfect Dark Zero when it launched, and that was a complete first-party game from an in-house developer. Second, why a Sunday release? November 12th falls on a Sunday, and I haven't seen a game release that wasn't in the middle of the week for quite some time. I believe it's being held back purposely to try and combat the release of the PS3, which is supposedly happening on November 17th. What are your thoughts? Thanks, and love the show.
Hey, Quentin from Ohio. Gears of War. So what's the problem with the $60 price? I didn't know there was a problem with the $60 price. I mean, you know what? They charge you because they can get away with it. But a lot of these games like have come down in price. In fact, Perfect Dark Zero came way down in price. Cameo, I think they were like $30 now. One thing to keep in mind is that games sell the most amount of... They sell their most in the first week. And then after the first week, the rule is what games sell the first day, they then sell in the first week, then they then sell in the first month, and then they sell like in the rest of the year. So it's the first week where they really, really make the most game sales. So yeah, of course they're going to be $60 because then they're going to wait and then they'll bring it down. So, and Gears of War, you know, this is a first party game. It's fantastic. I mean, I played it. It's fantastic. It's getting a ton of press. You know what? And people are getting used to that $60 price tag. So I'm not so big about that. The release, the Sunday release, November 12th, right ahead of the supposedly November 17th or so PS3 release. That's brilliant. I mean, freaking, I told you, Microsoft, I can't even believe. It's like every time I turn around, they seem to be doing something else like brilliant. Yeah, it's very smart because what they're trying to do is they get people in the store. They're trying to steal the PlayStation 3 Thunder. They get people to go to the store. They spend their $60 on Gears of War, so they have that much less money to buy their PlayStation 3. Also, if you're a kid and you go and say, oh, mommy, give me my Gears of War, and then you get this game. Of course, I don't know how many kids are going to be getting Gears of War, but probably a lot. And then you say, oh, now, mommy, give me my PS3. It's like, I just bought you that $60 game. I'm not going to be spending $600 on the PS3, are you crazy? Blah blah blah. So yeah, it's very, very smart. That's Microsoft's actually famous for this. They've been doing this forever. They're really, really big into stealing other companies' thunder. They love to like try to find out ahead of time, and then they'll announce like, you know, they used to do this a lot with Windows, is they would announce features in the operating system that was supposed to be in a Macintosh operating system or competitor's operating system. Like when handheld operating systems were originally coming out way back in the early 90s, they came up with their own, and they would just, it was all fake too. None of this existed. It was all vaporware, which you guys have heard of. And they just said this stuff like crazy so that no one would buy it. No one would buy the competitor stuff because they're waiting for Microsoft stuff. And then they never come out with it. So this is just good old common tactics marketing, and they're doing a great job. So expect people to flood the stores, and everyone's going to be talking about Gears of War, and hopefully taking down some of the pre-hype PS3, you know, coverage, because really the week up to the PS3 is where you get the most coverage. And by coming out with Gears of War, you're going to have Gears of War reviews right smack dab to all of those PS3 previews and coverage, and then sure enough, they're going to get tons of press. This is brilliant. It's brilliant. Next question.
Hey, Gaming Steve. My name's Adam, and I'm from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. First off, I'd like to thank you for mentioning and suggesting the World War books by Harry Turtledove. I'm currently about halfway through the first book and could not be more interested in it. Which brings me to my question. Have you ever read or even heard of the Doom books by David Abhu and Brad Lineweaver? And what did you think of them? For those who don't know, they are a series of four novels that add very intriguing and entertaining story to the games of Doom 1 and Doom 2. For anyone who enjoyed these games back in the day and enjoy reading, I would really recommend these books. Anyways, thanks again, Steve, for suggesting the World War books, and if you haven't read the Doom books, go out and get them now. Later.
Hey, Adam. Once again, is that advertisement? I don't think I like this trend of people advertising on the show like that, but I'm going to allow it because you did bring up a good point, and that is, yes, I've never read the Doom books, but I do have a couple of those books up. I have Warcraft books, Diablo books. There's Resident Evil books. There's Perfect Dark books. I really want to read the Warcraft books one day. I've actually heard they're pretty good. And one author of mine that I read, I've almost finished his last book. I've read every book. R.A. Salvatore, who does the Dark Elf series. Yeah, definitely check out his stuff. But yeah, I'm curious if anyone has read any of those books and would like to do a little book report, I will post it on the site. Well, talk to me before you do it. Don't just send me some emails. But I would love to do some reviews of those video game books. I really would. I'm just so curious. Whenever I see them, I think to myself, I'm like, are these things any good? I imagine some of them must be. There's just so many of them. And some of the Star Trek books are really great. In fact, I'm looking here. If you guys really like Star Trek, there's one Star Trek number 28, this Next Generation, called Here There Be Dragons by John Peel. That is a great Star Trek novel. They land on a planet where magic can happen, and it's crazy. So imagine Star Trek Next Generation on a planet with dragons. I loved it. I'm such a freaking geek. Last question.
Hey, Gaming Steve. This is Morgan from Scotland again. I've got a bit of a strange question for you here, but one I've been thinking about since you said a few podcasts ago that you'd done a bit of investing in games companies. I was just wondering how risky an investment that might be. Thinking about, well, potential successes like Vivendi with World of Warcraft. Clearly, I would imagine anyway their stock prices are doing pretty well just now, especially if you had invested a few years ago. And compare that to maybe someone like Take-Two with the hot coffee incident and all that hullabaloo. So that's kind of one part of the question. And the other thing is I'm just wondering how much investors are swayed by, say, influential reviews of games and how much that would affect the stock prices for a game company. For example, if a game was reviewed very badly in the press, would that necessarily affect the stock price? Anyway, that's my question for you. So, anyways, as I said before, it's good to have you back. Bye.
Hey, Morgan. How risky is it investing in a game company? Well, I can't give you guys investing advice. It's risky, okay? Vivendi, you know, gaming is a very, very small portion of all Vivendi. They're a huge company. So you really got to look at a company like, oh, I don't know, like Activision or Electronic Arts, ERTS, or THQ. Those companies actually, you know, Take-Two. Those companies, they do nothing but video games. So really, you know, how strong they do and how well they do will be reflected directly into stock price. But you know what? It doesn't. You really got to learn a lot about investing in general. Perfect example is Take-Two. Like back in the heyday when Grand Theft Auto was doing amazing, okay? You would think the Take-Two stock would do fantastic? No, because they had investigations on them. They were actually taking their money, and they were doing everything in their power to make sure they had as little profit as possible, because the companies have to continuously do better year after year after year. And if they had an amazing 2001, how are they going to beat that in 2002 when they weren't going to come out with a new Grand Theft Auto? So they did everything in their power to make sure that their profit was as small as possible, which investors don't like. So, you know, and then they were being investigated by the SEC. So the stock never really did take off and do that great. While you have other companies like Electronic Arts that they just keep doing better and better and better, and the stock price just got better and better and better, and they've really taken off. They've doubled in the last couple of years. So if you bought them a couple of years ago, you'd be doing great. But, you know, it's hard. I mean, Electronic Arts is a monstrous company right now. You know, for the stock price to double, the company has to get twice as big. So think about that. They have to make twice as much money this year as they, you know, for the company to really kind of get bigger. And I realize this isn't exactly true for those who are like, you know, investors out there, but I'm just sort of using a very, very, very simplified example. So, you know, you have to think to yourself, is they really going to do that much more business? Maybe not, but over time, over 5-10 years, will they continuously grow? Will they be bigger? If so, then it's probably a good investment, because in time, you know, the company will get bigger, they'll continuously be around, and in turn, the stock price will increase because it's worth more money. But things like Take-Two, I mean, they're getting freaking hammered. You know, they really, I used to love Take-Two, sort of. I loved their games, and I just thought if they really managed that company a little bit better and they were spending less time covering up illegal activities and a little bit more time running the company, that they would be as big as EA right now. But they didn't, and now they're probably almost out of business. But yeah, really, I'm, you know, if you want to find out more about those game companies, go to the Motley Fool. Motley Fool really loves Electronic Arts. They really, really love Activision, and they cover them in extreme detail, and they're going to give you really good detailed investing advice on those two companies. They also talk about THQ and Take-Two a bit. They don't like them quite as much, but they love Activision and Electronic Arts, as well as a couple of other fringe companies like Marvel, Amazon, things like that. But definitely check out them, and you can get really good investing advice on those game companies. That's it. All the time I have for questions. Once again, if you have any, you can send them to feedback@gamingsteve.com, and let's get to final thoughts.
Gaming Steve's final thoughts.
Hey, everyone. So, final thoughts. Yeah, I got to really wrap this up because I got to go. But I'm real excited. If you guys want to play an awesome game, Caesar 4, the demo just came out today. Caesar 3, love the game. I love all the city-building games. I loved Caesar 3. I loved Pharaoh. I love Zeus. I'm so looking forward to playing Caesar 4. It just came out today. I just finally downloaded it. I've installed it. I'm going to go play it right now. And, yeah, definitely check that one out. Can't wait to give that. I'm trying to get those guys actually on the show and do a little interview with them. But with that, I'm going to go look for the show. One thing is I might be doing the show every other week, because right now I'm trying to do it every week. I've just been so busy, and there's a lot of stuff going on in my life, and I don't want to disappoint people. So instead of me having to continuously miss deadlines every week, it might be better if I try to make the show every other week, and this way I can actually have it consistent. I haven't figured out anything yet, but don't be surprised if it's now becoming an every other week show, at least for a little while, until I can get things a little straightened out here. But I will be here. Those of you who are interested in writing for the site, look for an email very soon. If you're interested in writing for the site, you can write to me at feedback@gamingsteve.com. Tell me you're interested in writing for the site, and I'll send you out the email. And then look for lots of changes. Oh, and by the way, the forums, congratulations, they just had... It's been a year and a half, and there's now 200,000 posts in the Gaming Steve forums. That is insane. And Lady M does a fantastic job moderating that thing. She really could not do it without her. She really, really is phenomenal. Probably probably the best moderator I've ever seen. And luckily, she works for volunteers her time for Gaming Steve. And yeah, I mean, I remember last year during the summer, I remember I was actually watching it when we hit 10,000 posts, and I was all impressed and excited. 1 year ago, it was 10,000 posts. Now there's 200,000 posts. So in a weird way, I almost hope there's not 2 million posts in another year from now, because I think people would go a little insane and the database might crash. But no, so far it's going fine. I gotta go. I will talk to you guys hopefully next week, and have a good gaming week, everyone. See ya. Bye.
Listening to Gaming Steve. If you have a question or comment for Steve, please drop him a line at GamingSteve.com. Until next week, always beware the dark side. Or, if you're bored, give into it.